author of Terra Nullius and The Old Lie, Claire Coleman is a proud Noongar woman. And this week she's released her third book, Lies Damned Lies. Blending essay with memoir, Lies Damned Lies explores the myths and untruths of Australia's past, present and future through a very personal lens. I spoke to Claire while she was in Alice Springs ahead of the book's release.
My name is Claire G. Coleman. I'm a South Coast Noongar woman from Western Australia, and I am the author of the non-fiction book Lies Damned Lies.
A lot of people tend to frame colonisation in Australia as something that has already happened, and there was like a point at which it happened, and there is a pre and there is a post. But you've not just argued that there is an ongoing process of colonization, but you've introduced a word to explain that, pericolonial.
Well, the thing about the word pericolonial, the three prefixes are pre, peri and post, as in before, during and after. So the word pericolonial isn't really used in the language much. It's not really spoken about in research, it doesn't turn up. In fact, the search for the words pericolonial doesn't really come up on things like Google. But within the usage of the English language, if you can have a pre and a post something, you can also have a peri something. So, it is, and colonization is ongoing. It hasn't ended. We are pericolonial. In fact, we won't be post-colonial until we reach certain characteristics of a colony, which is an ex-colony is somewhere that has ceased being ruled by an outside government. We'd start being post-colonial when the head of state of the country is actually an Australian. That's just for a start. And so the process is still happening. And we can think of Australia as having had a pre-colonial moment, and we can think of a future post-colonial moment. But we're definitely not post-colonial now. And I don't think anyone, if they think about it clearly and if they have a knowledge of the topic, would ever say that Australia is post-colonial.
We're talking about language as a very precise tool. What value is there in being so precise?
Well, language is a precise tool, and language is also a tool that can be weaponized. And language is a tool that controls who we are. And the stories we tell ourselves about ourselves basically define who we are. And so being extremely precise in your language means that it has an effect on the subconscious of the people and of the society to be extremely precise. If we consider ourselves to be post-colonial, then perhaps we will not be kind of trying to stop the colonization. So we need to think of ourselves as existing during the colonization, otherwise none of this will ever get any better. So, and I think precise language is important. It's funny, as a writer, it's often my observation, the tiniest difference between a word and its apparent synonym can make a big difference when you're writing. So you have words that seem similar, have similar meanings, but they have a tiny, slight variation in the meaning. And that variation means more than people think it does. So I think we need to be precise about the language. And we are actually in the colony, so we are pericolonial. There's no other language use actually makes any sense.
I'm thinking of examples now of very off-topic examples of when an apparent synonym kind of embeds a different meaning. The contextual difference between someone laughing or someone giggling.
That's a really good one. And the subtext in language can have as powerful an effect as the intentional text. So someone's subconscious choice of a word makes a big difference. And even if you think of a simple example of someone saying they're going out with their friends or their girlfriends when in the English language, the way that the word girlfriends is used in mainstream Australian English suggests it's the same as saying your friends if you're a woman. But then you wonder why, in that context, men don't say they're going out with their boyfriends. So those little quirks of language can make a really big difference to the way we understand things. So I think we need to think about the meaning. And the example you give between laughing and giggling, that's a very strong one. Or laughing and sniggering, even.
Oh, there is a world of difference just between those two or three examples.
Yeah.
I wanted to kind of refocus. So in Lies, Damn Lies, you're exploring colonization through your personal and family experience. Why did you hone in on the personal?
Well, there's a couple of reasons. One of those reasons is that if you hone in on the personal, you can't be accused of trying to speak for somebody else. That's important. I think particularly in the context of modern First Nations culture, if people think you're trying to speak for everybody, it can cause problems. And if you say it's only from a personal point of view, it avoids that difficulty. And the other reason to deep dive into the personal is my family were profoundly affected by colonization, as were many families. And if we look at the personal, that kind of it makes it more immediate. This is my experience, my family's experience. It's a bit more emotionally impactful than a kind of dry analysis with no personal background behind it. Similar reason to why memoirs about people's experience are more compelling sometimes than just a factual work about the experience. Not that I've written memoir. There is a memoir aspect to it, but I haven't written memoir. But the idea is that if it's personal, it seems more visceral, and that's one of the reasons to go there.
I have been thinking a lot lately about the way that we talk about our stories, and also the way that we talk about the impact that traumas of colonization have had on us. We are often asked to expose our vulnerabilities.
Yes.
And I'm always kind of conflicted in this because it feels dangerous.
It does. And I think often we're expected to expose our vulnerabilities, or what some people talk about, trauma porn for the white folk, I suppose you could say it. We're often expected to expose our family histories and expose our personal pain in order to give that visceral feel to the non-Indigenous audience. And that is dangerous. I think it's dangerous for the person writing it. It's dangerous for their families. It can be an incredibly fraught experience to do that. And I think, to me, it's important that we acknowledge that the personal stories have an impact culturally, but that we also acknowledge that constantly expecting people to tell their stories of their family trauma has a limited use in fixing our society. It's only going to get us so far. I think it's time to make the personal more universal rather than deep diving deeper into the personal. And Aboriginal intergenerational trauma is pretty much universal in that all Indigenous people go through it to a greater or lesser extent. And especially when we consider that rather than the colonisation experience being 233 years ago now, 243 years ago, whatever it is, long time ago, it's not that long ago. In Alice Springs, there's people who, it was their own parents who were the first Aboriginal people to see white people in their area. In the Kimberley, not far from here, there was a family who did not leave the desert and meet their first white people until 1984. So the kind of the intergenerational trauma, not only is it impactful and huge and still a problem, but it's also recent. So, and my family, it was my great-great-grandmother who would have first seen white people come. So that's not long ago. So we need to dispense with this idea that we need to move on from intergenerational trauma, accept it's real, and accept that it's a very modern, real and recent thing to deal with.
In discussing or in mentioning kind of the danger of making yourself vulnerable in your writing, I wonder how you mitigated that, like how you navigated that balancing act.
I was acutely aware of the need to expose my feelings about colonization and turn my feelings into, I suppose, a scalpel to carve into colonization with. But I was also acutely aware of the need to protect myself, because I don't want to put my own trauma out there so obviously that people will use it to cause me increasing harm. Now, there's been some people who, among my friends and colleagues and associates, who have argued that I may be stepping too close to the line and maybe exposing myself to a bit of danger. And I may be exposing myself to a bit of hate from people who don't want to acknowledge the truth of Australia's colonisation. So it's important to me to find the line and try and stick to it. Now, I think I have managed to stick to the line. And that comes from maybe from experience, from being the fourth book I've written. Maybe that helps me keep to the line. Or maybe I stepped over and I didn't even notice. When I suppose time will tell how much danger I put myself in once the book is read by more of the public. Because at the moment, it's out in a week as we're recording this, so not that many people have read it and not that many people have told me what they think of it yet.
That must be such a disconcerting feeling.
The hardest time in the experience of writing and then promoting a book is the time between when it goes to print and you can't change anything and the time when the first reviews come out. Because during that time, you don't know whether you've achieved what you tried to achieve or made a total pig zero of it. So, and I've always, this is my third, promoting my, this first book, fourth book I've written, the third to be released because the other one was delayed. And it never gets any easier. This moment between printing and release has never got any, it hasn't got easier yet after three times. And maybe it never will, because I don't know. I don't know how people are going to react to it. I've had some positive verbal reviews from people, but I still don't know what's going to happen.
When it came to actually writing this book, some of these chapters are essays that you have, that you've written previously. How did the book come together?
It was suggested by my publisher at Ultima, who I'd worked with at Hachette. And the idea was to get my essays on colonisation and add some work. He wanted something a bit more like memoir, and I wanted further from memoir. So what it ended up being is using kind of memoir techniques to expand on the essays I'd written. And every chapter, well, not every chapter, but like a lot of the chapter, I think it might be two-thirds, are existing essays that have been expanded on and almost doubled in length to give a more personal experience of what they are about on a kind of an internal, personal level. And the other stuff is some new stuff that's written just to kind of expand on the concept. So it's kind of a hybrid between an essay collection and memoir and a long-form essay. Hybrid works are really fun. I'm not sure if the structure in which I wrote it is going to work out. We'll see. Time will tell, obviously. But it's a hybrid between an essay collection, a memoir, and a long-form essay. So I don't even know what to call it. I just call it a book.
Yeah, look, book works. In reading it, like, I did feel I felt like the origins of these chapters having been essays. I'm curious about who you see as the audience.
Well, all my works thus far, well, my two novels and then this one, Terra Nullius, The Old Lion, now this book, I consider my audience to be essentially people who are ignorant of Australia's history. There will be a certain, I think to an extent, it'll be of use to First Nations people in Australia, and largely in that, though, it might give them some ammunition in trying to unpack and question a colonial state in Australia. But like my other two books, the focus for the audience is actually ignorant non-Indigenous people, essentially. Now, I know that there's a problem with that, because what fan base I have gone out of the way because of reading my books to become less ignorant. So it's kind of like, in a way, everything I write since Terra Nullius is going to be preaching to the converted to a certain degree. But I just think the audience is, I suppose, partially is ignorant people who are ignorant of our history and need to learn a bit more, and partially people who want a new perspective on our history to help them understand it more clearly or even explain it to others.
Look, I had to laugh when you said that it's partly for people who are ignorant of Australian history, because there is a moment where you talk about one of the problems with the mythology of Australian history is the way people frequently confuse Cook for Phillip.
Yeah.
And I laughed because I have done that. And then when I mentioned it to somebody, his response was, I've done that too, largely because I don't care about either.
That's a good way to put it.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Cook and Philip thing is really weird. People seem to think that Cook and Philip are kind of important figures, and they conflate them because people don't even seem to know that Philip was the Commodore of the first fleet. Just like people don't seem to know that Cook wasn't a captain at any point when he came to Australia, that Cook only landed in Australia 3 times, and that Cook literally went from Victorian coast down near Mallacoota to the north of Cape York, and that's the only bit of Australia he ever saw. There's all these things about Australian history about Cook that people don't seem to know. Marsha Langton sometimes talks about people's inability to tell the difference between Cook and Philip, and suggests also from other times that possibly the issue is that we like to admire Cook and kind of hero worship Cook, but he actually hasn't done much to justify the worship with which he's treated in Australia. He didn't do that much for our history. He came here to the East Coast when he already had a map for the North Coast, the West Coast and the South Coast, started up the coast mapping it, and then went back to England. Once you know the history, it's difficult to understand why it's considered so important.
I mean, it's always been a bizarre thing to me because coming from a First Nations perspective, this is not a hero. But even if you are someone who's inclined to think of him as a hero, there's nothing particularly heroic.
No. And of course, the two historical mistakes of recent times that annoy me the most is Scott Morrison's statement is going to pay for a reenactment of Cook's circumnavigation of Australia. And of course, he never circumnavigated Australia, so therefore that makes it an enactment, not a reenactment. And when you think of it as an enactment, as they're enacting something that Cook never did, it makes you realise how much Australian history is actually false and an act when you think about them trying to reenact something that never happened. So that one's wild. And the other one is, yeah, the conflation of Cook and Philip, which happens all the time in politics, which doesn't make sense because Cook died 9 years before the first fleet arrived in Australia.
Would you happen to have a copy of your book with you?
I do.
Is there an excerpt that you could read?
I could. Hang on, just get my book.
Yeah.
it's on the floor.
Not a problem. This is a bit of a dealer's choice. Like, it's up to you.
I've got this thing. I have never read one of my own books all the way through once they've gone to print. By the time it goes to print, you've probably already read it 400 times. Because you go through edits after edit after edit. And I've never actually gone back and read something of mine. And I know of authors who have gotten to writing a sequel to their book and having to ask their fans if they can remember what happened in the book.
Yeah, I know of authors who do that as well.
But flicking through today, I found the introduction is a kind of good starting point.
Yeah, brilliant.
Words are weapons. Stories are dangerous, for they define who we are. They define our history. They can be weaponized. Stories and history are tools and weapons of war. Stories can be used as part of genocide, because if you say people are extinct, other people might believe it. Stories can be part of genocide because you can use stories to erase a culture. We are the stories we tell each other and the stories we tell ourselves. History is nothing but a story. A nation and its culture defined by that story, and the story is not always built on the truth. You might think you know the history of the colony of Australia, but do you really? History is trying to speak to you. It always has, from the birth of the colony in 1788 down to today. The ripples left by the wake of longboats still reflect from the shore. Can you hear it? Can you? Can you hear it? Can you? Can you hear it? I'm certain I can, but perhaps I listen more carefully than most. Do you listen? Are you listening? Do you even want to listen? Do you even want to know?
Author Claire Coleman there. Lies Damn Lies is published by Ultimo Press and available now. I'm Rudy Bremer, and you're listening to Away on Radio National.